Well, hi, it's great being here tonight. Thanks very much for inviting me. In a way, this is a very appropriate place for me to be, because one of the most recent communiques from the Surrealist movement in the United States was circulated here at the Independent Media Center and on the streets of Seattle in 1999. And it was called Who Needs the WTO? And so the Surrealist movement in the United States continues to be active. It has had a 50-year history, as Jonathan was mentioning, but it continues to be involved in all kinds of subversive events and creating ideas that can be useful in these kinds of festivals of resistance. So, given that, I thought that since maybe not everybody has had a chance to see that particular Surrealist document, I would just read you a paragraph from it. And it is also included in this book, Surrealist Subversions, in its entirety. And it's included in a book called The Battle of Seattle by Eddie Ewan and a number of other people. In my opinion, probably the best book so far to come out on that subject. So let me just read you a bit. Can you hear me? Is this mic working?
A little louder, maybe.
Is this better? Good. So did you hear anything of what I said before? Okay. You have the general idea, right? I'd like you to substitute NAB for WTO. Every time I say WTO in this, I mean, we could equally substitute NAB. It has that kind of interesting quality that these two organizations have some of the same invective that could easily be directed at either one. And interestingly enough, the word broadcasts appears in this 1999 document, even though it wasn't specifically written about this broadcast media related event tonight. I think it really fits that as well. So I'll just read you that one paragraph from the middle of the document. For us surrealists, the WTO, or NAB, represents everything loathsome and disgusting in this world and inspires only our revulsion. Almost to the point of caricature, it epitomizes contemporary civilization's disastrous hatred of the marvelous. The WTO / NAB can only, not only exemplifies the fear of poetry and love, the fear of human freedom, and the fear of wild creatures and places, it also broadcasts those fears, exacerbates them, and merges them into the great fear that paralyzes such a large portion of the US population today. The fear of being different, of being oneself, of being alive. This isn't the first time I've actually read that in IMC. I was at the Champaign-Urbana IMC about a month ago. And as part of this book tour, the book then was an imaginary book, which is very appropriate for a surrealist book, to do a book tour for a book that only exists in our collective imaginations. But now it is a very real book that, you know, was waved in front of you just a moment ago. And I think IMCs are, you know, very much the kind of place that all kinds of activities are happening that crisscross with media. And so that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. I'm going to try to crisscross a few different things. My interest in pirate radio, my interest in surrealism, and try to bring those together in new ways, perhaps. Okay. So that was 1999. This is 2002. What I'd like to do at this point is read you something that I wrote, just a short 3-minute piece for the Cascadia Media Alliance on the subject of media and democracy. A number of people were asked to write things and make statements about media and democracy. And what I tried to do in mine was bring in some of the kinds of mixtures of things that I just mentioned. And what I want to do for the rest of the talk this evening is develop some of those ideas that I stated in that brief 3-minute radio piece, really, and sort of extrapolate on that a little more and give you a better sense of what I mean. I'm hoping that some of the ideas that I throw out will be ones that we'll want to talk about and discuss, and I'm sure there'll be different points of view. Some of the things I say might be controversial, even among the people gathered here, and that's good, and I'd like to hopefully engage in a dialogue on some of those things. So I will read this in the standard format that everybody who participated in this project was asked to start with and end with. This is Ron Sokolsky, and I'd like to tell you something about media and democracy. As an anarchist, my affinity with democracy is not about voting for someone to better represent us, but rather taking action to directly represent ourselves. Just as I don't consent to being ruled by some politician, no matter how green, left, or libertarian, I don't trust some professional media talking head to frame my reality for me. My conception of how media and democracy are related involves a radical critique of both. I know a surrealist poet named Jane Cortez, and we were actually listening to her just a moment ago, who says in one of her poems, "Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it." So if we are to take the science that Jane is dropping on us seriously, we've got to lift our collective voices against injustice and on behalf of our dreams for a world of freedom. And when we do this together, we are each stronger for it, because we find our own voices in the process of passionately using them in our own chosen ways to resist oppression and to insist on liberation. Now, when we compare this radical vision of democracy to the miserableism of our currently mediated lives, we must inevitably confront the gap between the fatally compromised illusions that comprised what is called political reality and our own brightly burning desires for personal and social autonomy and an end to hierarchy and domination. It is then that we begin to question our socially assigned roles as passive citizen spectators and to demand control over the means of cultural production, representation, and distribution, which today are largely the domain of the corporate and public media giants. In so doing, we emerge from the velvet prison of consumerism and market demographics and become alive to revolutionary possibilities outside the one world of global capitalism. As we awaken from our media-induced trance, we unleash the insurgent power of the creative imagination, shake off the shackles of the reality police, and break the silence of cynicism and despair. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. For the Cascadia Media Alliance, this is Ron Sokolsky. So, with the element of participation, that's one of the things that's listed that I'm supposed to be speaking about tonight. Participation, I think it is, art, and I forget the other one, but they're all in here somewhere. Poet Jane Cortez's radical challenge to find your own voice and use it, and use your own voice and find it, can only be fully understood in a surrealist context. After all, she considers herself a surrealist poet. So I wanted to extrapolate a bit on that. As Lontremont once put it, poetry must be made by all. But surrealists are here talking not about having more trendy poetry slams, but creating a world in which people's lives are more poetic, where poetry is something you live rather than something you write. Given the depth of what surrealists demand, their strategies tend to be pretty radical. And if you think poetry is something that doesn't have radical implications, the surrealists are very much concerned with those implications. And it's interesting being here tonight because I was looking at the calendar hanging in the bathroom, which is the Watana Media Calendar of Jubilee Saints, which Jim Kenline put together, who was my co-editor on Going to Croatan, now lives in Seattle here. Some of you know him. And I noticed, maybe you could say more about this, Jim, maybe not. I noticed that it's a particular festive occasion tonight. Every day is a festive occasion in that calendar. This is the old Japanese Festival of Poets Night, just coincidentally. or using objective chance, as surrealists might say. It's also a day which has a picture of Georges Batty on it. Georges Batty was an early participant in the surrealist movement in France. Now, I'm mostly going to be talking about surrealism in the United States, but it's kind of interesting that those things would appear tonight, just at random. Surrealism, because it is involved with radical questioning of reality, is not populist. And its demands cannot be subsumed in the rhetoric of social democracy or recuperated in the bureaucratic language of corporations or regulatory agencies. Like anarchists, surrealists demand the impossible, pushing the boundaries of the possible into the uncharted terrain of the marvelous. Instead of confining themselves to the politics of the possible, which are rooted in a miserabilist acceptance of so-called realistic limitations, surrealists seek to create fault lines in our consciousness about what might be possible in a world of unfettered imagination. Here's where my interests in surrealism, anarchism, and micropower radio come together. Based on my research for the book Seizing the Airwaves and my experience working with Mbana Kantako at Human Rights Radio in Springfield, Illinois, I often find myself at events like this taking a critical position of the LPFM or low power FM strategy. And I think that deserves some further explanation. I don't think it's a strategy that is without merit, but I just want to clarify where I'm coming from in that sense. And I think there's plenty of room for collaboration between people who are taking that approach and people who prefer more of a pirate radio approach. With all due respect to the work of the folks at the Prometheus Project, people like Pete here, and really. And kudos to the handful of progressive stations that are now on the air. I was just talking earlier, and it seems like there might be as many as 10 of those on the air now with LPFM. That's all something that we should take very seriously. I just want to point out something that's very obvious to me and fits into what I was saying about surrealism and not being populist. LPFM is essentially a populist strategy rather than an anarchist strategy. It might have anarchist implications, and I think we should draw out those implications as much as we can. But it tends to be a populist strategy that involves getting government approval. That doesn't mean that we can't work together and fight the power in certain ways. And hopefully this gathering, this Reclaim the Media conference, is one of the places where those kinds of alliances can be formed and that kind of strategizing can start to happen. And I think it's very important to remember that the last thing we need is to be divided. And so we must avoid turning against one another. The FCC would like nothing better than to play divide and conquer with the micropower radio movement and the NAB as well. So, I'm not here to play the tired game of lefter than thou. I'm just here to kind of give you a sense of what some of the differences might be. All I want to do at this juncture is to clarify these differences in relation to our long and short-term goals, and hopefully there'll be feedback on some of this, whether these goals be explicit or implicit, and examine the strategies that diverse types of activists choose to achieve them, and figure out ways in which we can engage with one another in creating a strategy that's mutually reinforcing rather than unnecessarily divisive. We can start by asking ourselves the strategic question. Is our goal to achieve the institutionalization of our radical demands vis-a-vis radio in particular and media in general, or instead to demand the radical transformation of that which has been appropriated and institutionalized? Now, those are very different strategies in my mind. There might be places where they intersect and overlap, but for me, the goal is not institutionalization. This brings us back to the title of our convergence, Reclaim the Media. In one sense, this is a misnomer. And here's where I'm coming from on that. While there have been some distinct turning points in early radio history where things could have gone in a more populist direction, when it comes to radio in particular, and broadcast media in general, we're really not reclaiming what was ours in a simplistic sense. Rather, we're seizing or taking back what's been stolen from us by the NAB, and even prior to the NAB, by Clear Channel and prior to Clear Channel, before they ever even existed. In the case of television, this theft was structured right into the system right from the very start. There was no golden age in which we controlled the broadcast media. So strategically, we cannot reclaim what we never had. However, since the channels of communication have increasingly been strip-mined and clear-cut, and the mediascape has been brutally mauled in recent years, we can fruitfully recall a history of struggle, of opportunities lost, inspiring moments of resistance, culture jamming breakthroughs, and underground wellsprings of oppositional media that have surfaced, and some of which have survived over the years. Aside from these episodes in radical history, what we are reclaiming, I would maintain, is our ability to imagine a broadcast media that satisfies our deepest desires. And that's, to me, in keeping with the idea of surrealism. It seems to me that our activism should be based upon those dreams rather than the nostalgic myth of once having been in the driver's seat in relation to broadcast media. Thriving on dreams of revolt, surrealism has been a part of the radical political imagination since the 20s. Though even many radicals don't recognize the role of imagination as pivotal to social transformation, and even dismiss its value by contemptuously labeling it as, quote, unrealistic. How then might a radical media politics, whoa, got some interesting variations there. That was the dub version. How then might a radical media politics that recognizes the worth of both surrealism and anarchism be formulated? That's the question that I'm trying to grapple with. Instead of expanding upon a foundation of populism, we would be seeking out those elements of refusal which connect with both anarchism and surrealism, building upon them and seeking insights that might inspire us in exciting new directions while simultaneously raising the stakes not only of what is desirable, but of what is acceptable. Unlike that other great reclamation movement, Reclaim the Streets, there has never been an entrenched historical institution like the commons for media activists to call upon as justification for our demands in relation to the broadcast industry. So instead, we often use the word democracy. However, democracy is a very problematic term. In the U.S., it's been associated with, quote, the public interest in the case of regulatory agencies such as the FCC. But the bureaucratic concept of the public interest differs markedly from the commons concept. Aside from the tangibility of a concept that's literally rooted in the earth, the commons implies collective ownership in a way that the public interest does not. Instead of the direct democracy of the commons concept, we get the indirect democracy of the FCC's stewardship of the airwaves. While they claim to act in our best interests, in reality, that agency has been captured by the very corporate interest it supposedly exists to regulate on the public's behalf. However, though historically an inaccurate metaphor for the airwaves, I believe that we can poetically use the metaphor of the commons to spark our resistance to what is increasingly being seen as a new form of enclosure, not on the land, but in relation to the airwaves that surround it. So perhaps this week we need a fallen angel of the commons to go along with the angels of the public interest who will visit the NAB this next few days. Or alternatively, a Luciferian band of angels that playfully insist on an expanded definition of the public interest, which must include the commons, much more radical concept. I first sought to address this issue of the territorialization of the airwaves and the enclosure of radio and seizing the airwaves as a touchstone for envisioning an oppositional free radio movement. And this was envisioning was happening at the tail end of last century. And I try to understand the way in which radio piracy was a form of direct action. Since then, in his new book, Tearing Down the Streets, Adventures in Urban Anarchy, I don't know how many of you have seen that, it just came out recently, Jeff Ferrell engagingly places the free radio movement within the concept of the commons by examining such other challenges to restrictions on access to public space as Reclaim the Streets parties, critical mass rides, graffiti writing, busking, skateboarding, and other oppositional forms of DIY cultural resistance. As Ferrell puts it, pirate radio operators and street musicians would remind us that the streets exist not just in physical space, but as a contested ether of sonic space and communication, and would therefore point to the role of local governments and the FCC in closing down the city's lively cacophony. And he spends a bit of time talking about these laws, these restrictive laws that exist now in a lot of cities, about where people can busk, where people can, you know, play music and put out a hat. They have to be in a particular place, and according to some of the new urban gentrification policies. I'd like to, though, take Ferrell's skateboarding analogy because it's something that I've been thinking about for a while, and I'll apply it to LPFM in terms of my own experiences in the Midwest. I just recently moved from Springfield, Illinois, out here on the east coast of the Pacific Ocean. And I live up in BC now. And for the last few years before I left, Springfield was brewing. There were lots of things brewing in Springfield that were issues for public debate that had to do with the idea of a municipal skate park. Like many places in the United States, in Springfield, if you're conservative, you're considered normal. If you're liberal, you're considered radical. And if you're radical, you're considered crazy. Well, I had the crazy idea that creating a skate park was not the right strategy for radicals. I see skate parks as essentially a form of containment rather than a means of liberating the streets and public space from the yoke of corporate culture. Yet, what I found in Springfield is that faced with a hostile environment where conservatives routinely attacked skaters as, you know, degenerate scum and police arrested kids on the flimsiest of pretexts for invading the sacred downtown space that's reserved in Springfield for Lincoln tourists, state government bureaucrats, and their cohorts who are members of the state legislature. I found that people who I thought were on my wavelength, not just my radio wavelength, but my political wavelength, not only liberals, but also radicals, and even some people who considered themselves anarchists, were arguing for the legalization of skating via skate parks. In so doing, they accepted the circumscribed conditions that established these parks as a sanitized replacement for free access to the city streets. My argument against skate parks was more in keeping with Ferrell's and with a piece called, this is the title of a pamphlet that's put out by Venomous Butterfly, and it's called Against the Legalization of Occupied Space. And it's a pamphlet-length critique of the government-sanctioned Italian social center movement by two dissident Italian anarchists who go by the names of El Piso Occupato and Baroccio Occupato. And some Italian speakers in the audience. They argue against a legalization strategy and in favor of increasing the number of illegally occupied squats and the general growth of liberated social space as a much more appropriately anarchist strategy. So what I'm saying here then is, like, if we're going to chart an anarchist strategy, let's try to figure out what that would be. You know, it isn't always something that lends itself so well to this idea of democracy. In the same sense, we must ask ourselves, is our goal institutionalization or deinstitutionalization? This is, in essence, the question I raised in my LPM fiasco article, which was first published in Lit magazine about a year ago, in relation to the great debate that was then raging about LPFM as a strategy. And I argued in support of anarchist pirate radio stations within the micropower radio movement, which preferred to keep their stations unlicensed in order to avoid the co-optation of the free radio idea. Their emphasis was on eluding both government and corporate control. As I saw it then and continue to see it now, given the history that's transpired since then, Kennard, who was the FCC commissioner in charge, who originated the LPFM program, was merely offering us the carrot of licenses as a carefully laid trap to regain his agency's control of the airwaves at the height of the free radio movement's insurgent challenge to the licensing system through acts of civil disobedience and active resistance, i.e., going on the air. His goal was the liberal one of enclosing the micropower radio movement within the bureaucratic guidelines of government regulation while continuing his crackdown on what were increasingly seen as illegal stations that needed to be shut down. Not coincidentally, his enticements to normalization through legalization were cleverly designed to divide the movement. Now, of course, with Powell, the younger, we seem to get George the younger, and you know, we get lots of interesting dynamics in the Bush administration. With Powell the younger as the conservative chair of the FCC, even the containment-oriented LPFM program is in jeopardy, much to the delight of the NAB and NPR lobbyists whose efforts against it have paid off so handsomely. It's not out. It's not. It might be down, but it's not out, and there are lots of positive things happening within it as well. Just that it's no longer as broad-based and comprehensive as it was originally envisioned, even under the Kennard commissionership. Given the above dynamics, what's an anarchist to do? Some anarchists prefer not to involve themselves in reformist struggles, while others do so cautiously. And always keep in mind that mere legalization can never be the final goal. And such struggles are most valuable from an anarchist perspective if a grassroots movement can use them as a launching pad for making ever more radical demands rather than giving in to the desperate compromises of the bureaucratic survival game of just a few more crumbs from the banquet table, please. One question for anarchists is, in our protests, how do we create a situation in which the public belief in government solutions to political problems is undermined, rather than end up reinforcing the popular attitude that if only we had a more responsive government, everything would be okay? And as a surrealist question, we might add, how do we go beyond mere realism in both our strategy and our demands? These questions are, of course, important ones to address at the Reclaim the Media events here this week in Seattle. Rather than creating the illusion of a once-upon-a-time broadcast media democracy, in my opinion, we should be calling for nothing less than a radical break with the trajectory of broadcast media development ever since the early days of its existence at the beginning of the 20th century. For me, the need for a radical break cannot be automatically derived from a populist slogan like media democracy without some further explanation. For one thing, we must continue to be about creating galvanizing imagery and making artistic statements that break people out of their consumer trance and move them to action. As Franklin Rosemont, a founding member of the Chicago Surrealist Group, put it when describing the Bread and Puppet Theater back in 1989, as if in anticipation of the widespread use of puppets in the street demonstrations that we've seen with the anti-corporate globalization movement, he said, and I will refer to the book, he was talking about Peter Schumann's Bread and Puppet Theater and a particular production they did in Chicago called Insurrection Opera. And he said, Peter Schumann and his friends have sounded the tocsin for a resurgence of the best kind of magical utopianism. Reveries of a wildly desirable yet fully realizable world beyond the paralyzing dichotomies that enforce a system of exploitation and horror. Here, the crisis of consciousness meets the vengeance of dreams head on in a dazzling promise of a new day. Marvelously subversive, subversively marvelous, these puppets inspire a life larger than life, a jump for joy beyond all misery, a future worth its weight in light. So we must remember, and we do increasingly, and that's what's so exciting about the times we live in, include tactics in our actions that rupture mass-mediated consensus reality. I have a hard time saying that word. I don't like it much. And festively lift the veil on the NAB's corporate face by debunking their claims that they are only giving the people what they want, that in fact they are operating in the public interest. Hey, they do audience marketing studies, you know, and diverse consumer demographics determine their programming content. Isn't that democracy? Why, it's even multicultural. So, along with all the Reclaim the Media emphasis on making the corporate media more accountable, should be an emphasis on the other slogan popular among radical media activists, become the media. Do it yourself, DIY, or as Jane Cortez says, FYOVAUI, UYOVAFI. You know what that means by now. So, where does surrealism intersect with activism? According to African-American historian, cultural critic, surrealist, and author of Race Rebels, Robin D.G. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Thank you. You probably were not the only one. So according to Robin D.G. Kelly, who's probably best known for a book called Race Rebels, has a new book out called Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. And he gave a talk at the University of North Carolina to students there in September of 1998, which is included in the Surrealist Subversions book. And he later expanded that into a whole chapter of this book, Freedom Dreams. So I just would like to close with what he has to say in there and make another brief comment, then turn it over to you all. Surrealism is not some lost esoteric body of thought longing for academic recognition. It is a living practice, and it will continue to live as long as we dream. Nor is surrealism some atavistic romanticization of the past. Above all, surrealism considers love and poetry and the imagination as powerful social and revolutionary forces, not as a replacement for organized protest, for marches and sit-ins, for strikes and slowdowns, for matches and spray paint, not as a replacement for those things, in conjunction with them. And he goes on, surrealism recognizes that any revolution must begin with thought, with how we imagine a new world, with how we reconstruct our social and individual relationships, with unleashing our desire and building a new future on the basis of love and creativity rather than rationality. Here he's using rationality, he says, in the sense that it gets used to imprison us. George Clinton used to say that we need to dance our way out of our constrictions. He was being funny, but dead serious. Whether we call it dancing or dreaming or making poetry, we need to recognize that the hardest work we have before us is breaking the chains of imaginative slavery. If we want a new society, we have no choice but to supersede the dominant reality, to imagine a different relationship not only to the economy, but also to time, to work, to the natural world, and to each other. By superseding existing reality, we must break with the current injunction to, quote, keep it real. Of course, in contemporary hip-hop lingo, the power of keeping it real means many things. It's a challenge to commercialism, a recognition of the ghetto as a site of creativity, a call for solidarity with oppressed classes. But if we believe in revolution, we need to move beyond the real and to make it surreal. So, in all your activities this weekend, whether you're out there on the streets or at the teach-in, make it surreal, brothers and sisters, make it surreal. Thanks. We can begin to exchange dialogue, or I don't know, maybe people should just come up to the mic and make statements. I don't know what's best. Maybe we'll start with what's best? How should we do this? Okay, comments, questions, let's do that.
Can you repeat any questions?
Okay, yes.
What was the second book you mentioned that I missed?
Robin D.G. Kelly's book? Tearing down the streets.
Yes.
Tearing down the streets. Jeff Ferrell, F-E-R-R-E-L. The question was, what was the second book that I had mentioned? Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could kind of talk about the downfall of pop radio. I've been running into, I'm a constant caller of pop radio shows. I'm marginalized. The call screeners and the producers know my voice, and they do their best to silence my dissent. And I was wondering, have you experienced, have you checked out that the way that they just take some issues just off the table? They won't talk about some issues.
Okay, the question is, why is talk radio so fucked up? On mainstream talk radio, they're in control. Not only do they determine whether you get on, but how long you're going to talk, and they can cut you off at any point. Here's where becoming the media comes in. Whether you're doing it through LPFM or whether you're doing it through pirate radio, when the media is ours, when the talk radio show is one that we're producing, you get very different results. And so I think that's a clear indication that that's the direction we should be going.
I just sure would like to go and encourage more people. Sometimes I feel like a lone wolf out there calling these shows. Some of the hosts are even progressive, and they cut off the debate because it doesn't please the advertisers, it doesn't please the producers. So I just want to get more people.
That's right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and the problem is the context, too. Because if advertising is part of it, whether it's done with, you know, through NPR with testimonials for sponsorship of a program, or whether it's done through commercials, particularly blatantly with commercial radio, you call up and you say your radical, you know, heresy, and then there's a commercial for Starbucks that follows, you know. Or there's an underwriting for a petroleum company with, you know, the, you know, NPR, right, yeah. Okay, other questions, comments?
You mentioned your meeting briefly. I was wondering if you could expand your views on that.
Yeah. I think that, you know, first of all, I mentioned Jeff Ferrell's book. His earlier book is called Crimes of Style, and it's about graffiti. And he himself was involved, lots of graffiti activity in Texas at the time, in Denver, Colorado. Basically, what it's about there, and the reason he brings it in and it fits into our own argument here, is if public space is a way of looking at the commons, this old idea of the commons, where there was this space that we all shared, that was something we all owned collectively. When a corporation decides to rent a billboard at an exorbitant price that we can't afford, they get to put up their graffiti and their logo, and you know, they get to tag things. We don't get to do that. We don't get to say what we need to say in public space. And so it's sort of a way of looking at this issue as not just an issue that's related to a particular, you know, group of people who are, you know, being arrested for vandalism, and you know, is this vandalism or is it not? It really connects with this idea of who has control over public space, and the degree to which we've lost that's been stolen from us, and we need to reclaim it, because increasingly it's becoming harder and harder to have, your voice be heard. In that public kind of setting, the airwaves are another one. Yeah.
What came first? The people's
the egg.
Ability to listen or a soundbite? My point is what would you consider the longest for an interview? 20 minutes, 5 minutes? And I use what Ralph Nader said. What kind of response do you want? 2 second response, and you need to go boom.
Yeah, we're back to talk radio and sound bites, and and please, other people, if you want to answer some of these questions with me, feel free. I mean, there are lots of people in this room who are very aware of some of these issues. My own take on it is that this idea of the sound bite is one that reality tells us that we need to learn how to do in order to get heard in the mainstream media. But really, we should be questioning the whole idea of sound bites as a way of communicating with people, because we play into this idea that this is essentially a form of communication that is a valid way of, you know, addressing issues, and that can be substantive, when in fact it's an impoverished way of communicating. So I think we have to challenge that. I mean, even if someone shoves a mic in your face and, you know, you might, you know, kind of give them the soundbite they're looking for, especially to avoid having a little bit taken out of your 20-minute rap that you wouldn't necessarily approve of, I think it's important for us always to keep in mind that the soundbite is something that is not part of the dream. It's not part of, you know, the kind of reality that we can imagine. It's part of the, you know, miserablest way in which we're forced to communicate.
You made a comment about surreal events at the beginning. I just want to make an observation about how surreal events happen more often when you participate in an event or just keep your eyes open for it. They happen every day, and sometimes they just go overlooked.
Do you want to give us an example? Okay. Surreal events. I'll give you an example. It's in the book. Yeah, no, I think that's as great as to kind of be aware of what's around you in a way, and the way things that, you know, just we take for granted and don't examine very deeply can have surrealist implications. And some of the folks in the U.S. surrealist, you know, movement have come up with this little game that they do, which is very appropriate to us here at the Independent Media Center. It's called Latent News. And here's the way it works, and then I'll read you an example of it. One or more persons cuts out each individual line from several different newspaper stories, mixes them up, and then rearranges them as quickly as possible into entirely new stories, the only rule being that the lines must be rearranged into syntactically correct sentences. The name is derived from the impulse behind the game to disorder the mystification called news, and thereby to reveal something of its latent content. So this is one that was done by Don LaCosse, and he did it last year, and he compiled it from the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and his own daily newspaper in La Crosse, Wisconsin, the La Crosse Tribune. He has the interesting distinction of being Don LaCosse, who lives in La Crosse. I always tease him about that. Anyway, he titled it A Growing Crisis. And so this is what he put together. Uncompromisingly bleak and protesting homosexuality, the White House will release tomorrow a joke about presidential assassination. They offered a variety of reasons. We don't have the plague, said a spokesman. Thousands of teens cheered as about 600 workers lost their jobs. The fast-moving storms and the dogs continued to act out enthusiastically. The analysis published in the journal said that there is an undercurrent of twisted sexuality and deception is widespread. Stock market volatility has analysts concerned. It was first reported that the economic recovery plan cut lots of acorn fruit for wildlife, including ducks. Another 11,000 jobs will be cut after being struck and dragged. Eventually, it will rot. The Bush administration said it would delay for a year charges of animal cruelty, raising concern that it was a logical result of the school reform legislation. One more paragraph. Although there has been a growing awareness of the problem of light, the American economy remained shaky at the end of that difficult meeting. With tensions soaring in this tinderbox, renegade morning doves blanketed the sky, collapsing Friday as winds blew with bands of color ranging from purple, red, and brown. Those involved in the negotiation said the existence of Martian microbes must undergo a psychiatric evaluation. I have no doubt, said a shark about 8 feet long. It was almost impossible. Police officials said a bomb was apparently needed in this diverse economic hub, made especially of ice. So.
You know, it's so hard to parody the news. I mean, it's such a parody of itself already, right? So this is one way of just trying to go a little deeper with that idea. You know, you just listen to the news, and you know, can you really make a parody out of what some of these fools have to say? You know. All right, other questions. You already asked one, so I'll get back to you. Yes. Okay, so this is, deinstitutionalized media. Let's take LPFM. LPFM was offered to the micro power radio movement, to the free radio movement, during a time when people were already going on the air. Okay? It was offered as a way, in my opinion, of institutionalizing that which was being done by people already, as a way of capturing it, as a way of enclosing it, and so on. So in my opinion, then, the idea is not to find ourselves in situations where we view that kind of institutionalization as a victory, but especially as a victory that doesn't have problems attached to it. If there are problems attached to it, and if there are other ways that we can proceed, then it's important to do that. One of the things that I've always admired about the Prometheus Project is that even though they go around the country, you know, helping people, you know, get these licensed stations, they've never been hostile to the pirate radio, you know, folks who don't want licenses. And they've always been, you know, in solidarity with us. And so I think that's an important kind of distinction to make.
I want to say that I really liked your article on LPFM Fiasco.
Thanks. Right. Well, yeah, at the end, not completely, but largely, I think. Okay. Okay, so the question is radical grassroots media, what would they be like? This is a perfect opportunity for me to move to the side and to turn the mic over to any number of you who want to get up and address that question, because it's exactly the kind of question we should be addressing here tonight and for the rest of the week. So, open mic.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was initially a question I was going to direct at you, but I guess it kind of applies to all of us. I'll ask it that way. You know, in identifying yourself, I guess ourselves as radicals, are you not internalizing an aspersion of the oppressor? If anything, I gather from your statements that surrealism is more essential to human vitality than the status quo. And, you know, I guess that applies to all of us. Why are we radicals and not them? Why have we internalized this? Why have we pigeonholed ourselves into this term of being radical? Because I don't think of myself as radical, you know. I just think it's backwards, you know.
I know not everybody here would define themselves as a radical, and that's okay. I don't mean to say you have to be a radical. I'm just trying to make distinctions in terms of how you see yourself and the kind of strategies that you choose. So anybody can come up to the mic.
Well, I don't know much about this. I've never worked with pirate radio, but I guess just... that's right. I apologize. You're exactly right. I mean, just kind of stating the obvious again, there are resources out there. You know, there are libraries, there's the internet, there are websites, there's a network in place. You know, utilize it. And let those who have kind of laid down the tracks kind of help the rest of us along the way. And this, I'm just so excited about this. You know, we're all very excited about this 6-day convergence of just letting people teach us how to do this and get a better definition of where radical or democratic media has its place in the future. Stating the obvious, really.
Somehow to me it seems like we've let the media and George Bush and all these people claim all these terms, you know, like radical. How much more radical is it than to go into a country with bombs without any agreement from anyone? They're the radicals. I'm not a radical, you know. I totally disagree with them, but I'm not a radical. Radicals are in there now. That's how I see it.
I guess for me, the problem really lies with reaching the people that aren't the choir. You know, I spend a lot of time looking at internet, scan TV, that's our public access station here, and I don't know, I feel like I'm sort of just bolstering my own ideas already. So what interests me about the possibility of having something like pirate radio out there is connecting to the people that are sleepwalking. I mean, I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but it feels like most of the people you encounter are sleeping, and they're just kind of plugged in to the matrix or whatever you want to call it. And so how do you shock people into thinking another way? And so for me, I'm trying to think of some way. Well, you could put up posters on our newly liberated telephone poles with, you know, something that would attract the eye to let people know that certain pirate station, like I guess 101.1, is going to be pirated here in a couple days for the 3 days starting tomorrow. So tune in for that. So I heard on the internet or saw on the internet. But I guess I'm just wondering how to reach the sleepwalkers. Back in the 60s, there was a group in San Francisco called the Diggers, whose big thing was to go around and do street theater. And one of their real big things was doing free anything, because it blows the capitalist mind to have things that are free. So they had the free clinic and free clothes and free food. And that, you know, people would turn and say, what the hell is this about? You know, and it would catch people's eye. So I don't know. It's just, to me, I'm really hoping that at this conference or anti-conference in the next few days, that I learn some more about how to reach the, you know, or how to unplug people from the matrix, I guess.
This isn't very surrealistic, but the history of our country was based on a bunch of people, all ages, who got together in a room and basically hammered out the Declaration of Independence, all the way from Ben Franklin, who you may think be just a capitalist pig, but he was an old guy, down to Jefferson and them guys who were in their 20s. And I think we're at that crossroads all over again. I mean, just superimpose our government into the British, you know, huge, you know, just the whole thing that they were doing back then. And I think something that Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we'll definitely hang separately. And we're at that point again. I mean, those people worried for their lives, and what do we have to lose? A few hours of our life here, you know. So I think going out there and having a good time and letting people see that we are having a good time is really what we're trying to achieve anyway, you know, quality of life, to be all of us be poets. So that's why I'm here personally. But, you know, we got to get to the point where we're really motivated, and I think that would be a motivation for me.
I think the general question that spurred the ceding of the microphone to the audience has kind of been answered. We're not the audience anymore. The microphone is ours.
I was listening to a streamcast a couple of weeks ago, and Amory Lovins, have you ever, anybody ever heard of him? He gave this amazing presentation all about alternative energy, which is pretty exciting. But one of the things he concluded with was a recent statement from the Hopi elders, which is that we are the people that we have been waiting for. And I just thought that was pretty good news.
I believe it's September 25th. Help me out if anyone knows. Northwest Renewable Energy Fest in Walla Walla, Washington. I think it's September 25th. Go to, you can just plug it in a search box. I don't even know the website. I think if you can just put in like NWRE Fest or Northwest Renewable Energy Fest. Late September, Walla Walla, if you're interested.
I just went to the most surreal event that I know about. It's called Burning Man, and I want to just point out that a bunch of people running around with megaphones yelling whatever they think is kind of annoying.
Good people. Every single one of you can make a difference here. The power of one person to affect change on our community and on this issue, and on the NAB, and on the WTO, is really beyond measure. Please do not buy into the idea that you are powerless, that your voice doesn't matter. Don't let them confuse you with a lot of mumbo jumbo that you don't understand the issue, so you can't do anything about it. Understanding it enough to know that you don't like it is enough. And, you know, damn the media for marginalizing us so. Damn them for not presenting anything that would bring us together like this. This doesn't happen in the media. The mass media doesn't want this. This is very, very contrary to their agenda. Good example, but I just wanted to remind everybody that one person can make a huge difference.
I wanted to ask a question and see if any of you have an answer for me, because I want to play devil's advocate for just a second. Like when he was talking about calling into talk radio, I've had some experiences with that too, but let's say the opposite thing happened, that now we don't have any producer, you just call in and the talk show host just lets you talk and you go on for an hour. Well, now the show's over, nobody else got to talk. You know, so where does the responsibility come in? Is it a matter then of each person has to be personally responsible for what they say? And what if they aren't? Is there no regulation at all? So I just wanted to kind of open that question up for anybody to comment.
I think that I get really bad stage fright, so I'm going to turn a different way. I'm sorry. I think that in that situation, somebody has control of the knowledge. Sorry, I need to not look at the audience. In that situation, somebody has control of the knowledge of how to operate the radio. Somebody has control of the knowledge of how to broadcast that. Dialogue or whatever that person has to say. And I think in answer to the question that spawned the open mic, I think a new model for appropriate communication between each other is one where knowledge is shared rather than nobody has control over the knowledge. People who have, if knowledge equals power, people who have the knowledge aren't motivated by some external source to keep it to themselves. So in response to the original question, I think that what is the new model for media? This is the new model for media. This is where we share our knowledge. These workshops is where we share our knowledge of how to communicate with other people. And I think there's a lot of the idea that technology is kind of bad. I don't think it's bad. Knowledge or control over the knowledge of how to use it is bad. Yeah, that's.
Ron brought up so many intriguing questions and visions. I'll be thinking about them in these next few days for sure. And on this question of whether to create a local democratic or local direct participatory media to do that institutionally or within the institutions or outside of the institutions, I think is a really intriguing question. And it makes me think about a group that I worked with on Vashon Island. And basically, I saw a community there who knew very organically that they wanted to have their own community radio station. And they've been wanting this for years. A lot of people live there, love the community that they're in. They know that it's very rich with artists and musicians and all sorts of progressive voices, and they have a lot to share with each other, they have a lot to say, and they don't have a means for doing that, really. apart from things like just having emergency news available to them that they don't get from the Seattle news sources. And they took the opportunity of the internet to pull together a community radio station and go online. They're at voiceofashan.org. And they also put in an application for an LPFM license, knowing that they didn't have a qualifying frequency. But they just wanted to make a statement that, in good faith, we are trying every means available to us to set up our own community radio station. And they found studio space. They do a daily broadcast. They do live broadcasts and pre-produced programming. They go to public hearings and record all that and make it on demand, available online. And they're self-organized, and they have the love of the community. People are really charged up about them. But really, they still come up against the fact that everybody on the island just wants to be able to turn on the dial and hear radio the way you're supposed to hear it. Or, you know, not the way you're supposed to, but the way that people are used to. And that would be much more convenient to them when they're at home or when they're in their car or when they're carrying their transistor radio around. And so what I see is institutions getting in the way of something that's come up so organically from the community, and it seems like just a good, right thing. And so there must be something wrong about the institutions that don't let that be. And it does make me think a lot about how to not be bound by the patterns that we're expected to be bound by.
I just kind of wanted to, that kind of segues into, just the issue of technology. And, I think it's important to keep this in a context of current technology, current broadcast technology. Right now we exist in a circumstance of imposed technological scarcity. It is possible in this current day and age for, radio to be completely digital, for there not to be bandwidth constraints, frequency constraints, as was the case perhaps 5, 10, just in the previous history of media. It is possible to have radio that's essentially like the internet, where the client determines what they're interfacing with, and you can essentially have an unlimited space for audio channels to take place. I mean, look what happens with cell phones. If they can do it with cell phones, they can do it with radio. It's just that we exist in a circumstance where the technology and the facilities to do this are controlled by corporate interests. So another tier to take this into is trying to analyze how we can, I guess reclaim is kind of the lingo, the lexicon of the day, whether or not it's accurate, but try to reclaim these systems that have come under corporate control, because there's no reason why any one of us can't just, start our own station, just broadcast it, and everyone else, they can just connect to it. The technology exists for that. The technology exists for that to be done feasibly and economically. It's just we exist in the current circumstance of, distribution of information has taken market priority, and it's been given that priority in large part as a method of control and oppression. And, it's necessary to realize that we exist in a circumstance where, that doesn't have to be the case.
I have to jump for this one here. Sorry. Probably good enough. Thank you. I'm a little different than you. I have a real job. Probably that's something that I didn't have a long time ago, and I did all those great kinds of things like live on the streets and everything you have to do. Vietnam. Anyhow, now though, I work at the University of Washington in the surgery department, and I'm sort of test marketing what I think you will be doing. I have a research project out there with patients who are there because of a disease, atherosclerosis. But at the same time, I have the luxury of having to talk with these people about an hour, four times a year. And all I have to do, medicine-wise, is do a little physical, a little vital sign work, and take them to some other tests. So I get to learn who these people are and what they're doing. I have 190-some people in my study. Those people are basically 90% Seattle VA Medical Center, so you get the idea where they've been. And I want you to know, I test the waters a lot with my own political ideas. I'm not supposed to, but I do. And I can tell you that there is an audience out there. And there's not only an audience out there, there are people who want to talk to you. There are people who would love to talk on the media with you all. And I don't think they'd necessarily dial a phone and talk to you in a talk radio show. But if you went over to the Seattle VA, if you sat in rooms like the waiting rooms out there and just said, we have some questions, who's here waiting too long? You've got people to talk with, and you've got people who will listen to that. They're listening to each other at that point. I mean, we knew this years ago. We never got a chance to prove it, but it's sitting out there. So they're waiting, so hopefully you'll get there too.
There was a guy that was up here earlier who was talking about his frustration in dialing into talk radio and not getting heard, not being able to address issues. And it kind of sparked an idea in my head, which was to call in and present oneself as a sort of right-wing conservative person. And then in a sort of a very logical way, a logical escalation progression, get more right-wing and more unecological and more bloodthirsty and more paranoid to such an extreme that the person that you're talking to starts to become more compassionate and thinks, hey, wait a minute, but it's a logical progression from his point of view to this other point of view that you're espousing, and maybe that's a subversive and surreal way to get in.
One last thing for me, and I just wanted to touch on something that you said earlier about how do we wake people up, and thank you. How do we get to people who are in the matrix, so to speak? And I was going to recently move down to Tacoma, and I'm really happy that I'm staying, because now I might get the chance to do many things, one being maybe instigate some kind of bus theater, because it's free and you have a trapped audience. And I just wanted to put that out there as kind of food for thought, maybe sow a seed of a new form of theater, or maybe a reinvented form of theater. I'm sure it's been done before somewhere, but I just figured, what a brilliant idea. It's like you could just kind of get on, do your thing, and get off. And you know, people, it's like, if they don't like it, what are they gonna do? Like, get off, you know, be late to work? I don't think so. You know.
Hi there, fellas. I walked all about 10 miles from the U district from here, and that's because of the emotional fire that I lit my ass off just to get here. But anyhow, I know that one of the reasons here, one of the aspects of media reform is public broadcasting reform. And the reason I support media reform is because I mostly support public broadcasting reform there. I'm not quite a member of the so-called Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting, was a website at cipb.org. But I do vouch for them. And And what right now, one of their main issues is not only funding and membership, with a branch being opened right here in Seattle and temporarily being based out in the east side, but also the sale of WQED. And that really angers me. But once this all these issues have been taken care of, I hope that the ultimate goal of public broadcasting thing, the complete elimination of endowments and with the replacement by a licensing fee or licensing tax from corporate or commercial broadcasters that they use to get their broadcasting license. And I completely support this. I really do. And if you want more information, just go to cipbonline.org to find out more and how to join this newly open branch up here in Seattle if you live up here. Thank you.
I'm a big chicken at this, so you'll just have to bear with me a little bit. Johnny, I love that idea of reverse COINTELPRO. There you are. I used that at my surreal, not really real job at a very evil corporate company, which I'm not going to admit to working at because I don't have anything to shield my face. So that lady who was standing over here, you're not the only one with a sort of real job. But we started this conversation with the idea of what's radical, and somebody said it was a root, and that's true. But really that concept of radical, you know, that label, radical, all of you people, because you walked in the door here, are radicals, is something that the media put on you. That's an interesting connotation. I mean, that's an interesting thing to ponder, because who are they? You know, they're the conservatives. They're the loggers, they're the whalers, they're, what's that other word? I particularly gets my goat every time I read it in the newspaper. The environmentalists oppose. Who are the environmentalists? You know, are they the ELF? I mean, certainly, I'm sure a whole bunch of people in this room agree with the ELF, and then there's other people here in this room who work for the UW, and all of them consider themselves environmentalists. God help us, there's people at Weyerhaeuser and Willamette who think they're environmentalists. So who are those evil environmentalists, and who are those evil loggers, and who are the evil corporate heads? And I think maybe one thing that helps your cause, Ron, and free radio, is if we all step back and say, well, what labels am I using, and who am I putting into a corner, and boy, I'm better at this than I thought I was. And who's the person behind the labels? And like this lady working with these people from, I'm sorry, I forget where. You know, who are they, and what are their experiences? I used to wait tables, and I used to wait tables on people like fishermen. You know, when we were all signing those petitions outside of Safeway that said we should ban fishing in Puget Sound. The thing I thought was so funny about that petition is that those fishermen the year before had only gone out twice. Twice they had fished in Puget Sound the year before. 4 hours they got. One guy told me he came back with 23 fish. And it bothered me because I thought, who was behind that movement? Was it the environmentalists? Was it the maybe the building industry, maybe the politicians who wanted to be able to pat themselves on the back? I mean, who were the people? You know, maybe it was Iman, I don't know. Anyway, I think when you get back to that dancing and people and finding your voice, I wish you'd repeat that so we all get it right, that big, long, 10-letter acronym? I don't know, maybe we should listen too.
So, hi. Well, we've had a wonderful evening of conversation, and I don't want to curtail any more that's forthcoming, but it's 9:30. So anybody else have a burning desire to add to our conversation? Or Ron, would you like to have a last word?
It's not the last word, it's just an announcement. There are some copies of Surrealist Subversions there, as well as some freebies. So the freebies include a newsprint thing on Surrealism, and a Surrealist event that's coming up on the 23rd of September, which people will be participating in all over the world. So feel free to come to the table. I'll be there, we could chat.